Coming up on Philosophy Talk, Michel Foucault and power. What does it mean to have power?
I'm very uncomfortable. I have no power. Why should she have the upper hand? Once in my life, I would like the upper hand. I have no hand, no hand at all.
Is power a matter of top-down control? Or is it, as Foucault thinks, distributed across society? Is power everywhere you look?
How do I get the hand?
We all want the hand. Hand is tough to get. You gotta get the hand right from the opening.
Power can be used for positive social ends.
That's good.
But it can also be used for control.
That's bad.
But resistance is always possible.
That's good.
But resistance is also part of power.
Oh, come on.
Our guest is Gary Gutting from the University of Notre Dame.
Foucault and power, coming up on Philosophy Talk.
In this season of giving, we want you to know that we are grateful to you, our listeners.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you for thinking.
And thank you for supporting Philosophy Talk.
What is power?
Who has power?
And can we ever escape its clutches?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor.
And I'm Josh Landy. We're here at the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where I teach philosophy and Josh directs the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today we're talking about Foucault and power.
So Foucault's a great guy to think about when you want to think about power and power relations.
Right. I mean, you know, take his idea that power is everywhere. It's all over the place, even places you wouldn't expect it. I mean, you might think you're doing something really benevolent, like coming up with humane punishment for criminals, but very often you're just exercising control over
it. Yeah, that's part of it. But power isn't just a matter of getting other people to do what you want them to do. It's not just a matter of control. It's a matter of, like, ontology, of getting people to be what you want them to be. I think Foucault thinks that power somehow determines what kinds of people there are.
How can power do that? I mean, there are tall people and there are short people. There are straight people and there are gay people. White people and black people. What's all that got to do with power?
Well, take one of your examples, being gay, or any of them would do, but take being gay. That's not just a matter of, you know, like biology or behavior or whatever. To be gay is to be located in a whole nexus of power relations.
What are you talking about?
Come on, go back to ancient Greece. There were lots of men who do the things we think of characteristic of gays. They slept with other men, for example. But you know what? There weren't any gay people.
How can you say that men were in relationships with other men, but there weren't any gay people?
Because back then, gay was not a social category. Nobody could possibly think of themselves or organize themselves or think of anybody else as gay.
Okay, but even if I grant that, what's it got to do with power?
Well, it's because it's power that decides what social categories there are, how they function, who belongs to them, Josh. Power does this.
So you mean that if the powers that be say all literature professors are aloof, tweed jacket-wearing aesthetes, I'm suddenly going to start thinking of myself that way?
Yeah, well, Josh, you're wearing a tweed jacket right now, dude, aren't you?
Okay, you got me there. But still, even if we do fit ourselves into existing categories, that doesn't have to be limiting. I mean, plenty of people see their identities as sources of pride.
Maybe they do, but the point is that these identities, these socially given categories, they tell you what to think and how to think.
That's definitely not true.
No, it is. Bear me out. Think about ancient Greece. Why weren't the Greeks asking questions about, say, gay rights? Well, because, Josh, they couldn't possibly have done that. That wouldn't have made any sense. That's not even a possibility within their cultural framework or what Foucault likes to call their episteme.
Episteme. He really did like his fancy new words. So what does that one mean exactly?
It's not that fancy. It's something like a paradigm. It's all those background assumptions that we may not be even aware of, frequently aren't aware of, but nonetheless they guide and control and constrain our thinking in every single area of life.
Okay, so they guide our thinking. They don't tell us what to think.
No, you underestimate the power of the episteme, Josh. The episteme can lock us into a way of thinking.
If that was true, no one would ever disagree with each other like you and I are right now. And besides, Foucault
somehow magically came up with this unprecedented idea. How did he do that, Ken, if his mind was totally enslaved to power?
Because thought does not change thought. Power changes thought. You see, you just want to reject Foucault's entire theory of power. That's your problem.
Oh, no, not the entire theory. Just the loopy parts, Ken. Look, I'll tell you one thing I think is really brilliant in there, and that's the idea that we need to stop thinking about power as us versus them. We need to stop thinking on the model of, you know, a tyrant oppressing the people or a ruling class exploiting the workers.
So now you're getting with it. You like his idea, his rejection of Marx, it sounds like.
I do. I mean, I think he had this really interesting thought that, you know, Marx just isn't going to cut it for the modern age because there's no center of power anymore. There's no one person or one class telling all of us how to live.
No, there's no center of power. Are you really denying that there's no, you want to say there's no top-down power these days? I mean, does even Foucault want to go that far?
Well, you know, however much we're being oppressed from the top, that's nothing compared to what we're doing to each other. We're all acting as enforcers. You know, every hour of every day, we internalize the norms of our society, and we end up reproducing them willy-nilly. Every single one of us, whether we know it or not, is a conduit of power.
And that's the thing you like in Foucault. Man, that's the thing you like. I find that part a little, like, troubling and depressing, dude.
No, you got it wrong. It's empowering, Ken. I mean, once you realize that injustice isn't always a matter of bad people exerting power over good people, but that it can be systemic, that's a game changer.
Well, I see your point there. I mean, think about the Black Lives Matter and other movements. Its representatives have fully taken on board the Foucaultian idea that it's the system that's unjust. It's not a matter of individual consciousness, of our individual intentions and thought. I mean, even people with perfectly good will are usurped by the system.
Exactly. And quite a few activist movements today are inspired by Foucault, actually. And we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Liza Veal, to find out just how theory becomes radical practice. She files this report.
There are some things that aren't on the ballot that I would like to vote for.
This is Mark Bamuti Joseph, an artist and curator with the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts in San Francisco. He spoke at a summit right before the 2018 midterm elections.
I would like to vote for Black beauty as an aspirational standard. I would like to vote for Black health as a civic priority and for Black life as something that matters. Yeah. I would like to vote for the feeling that I get when I hear Roberta Flack and Donny Hathaway sing The Closer I Get to You.
The closer I get to you.
That to me would be a hell of a democracy.
The title of this summit was Reimagining Political Power. A lot of people there were frustrated with the institutional political process. They looked for hope elsewhere. And though no one talked about Foucault, you could draw a straight line from his ideas to the political role that Joseph sees for cultural spaces like his.
We begin with the premise that culture precedes policy, that we're here to generate culture so that the most number of people feel the most kinds of agency because they're inspired by a place like this.
It's not hard for people in social justice spaces today to see what culture has to do with power. It's been almost 50 years since the slogan, "The personal is political," was coined. Foucault is a big part of why these ideas make sense to us today.
Foucault never encouraged anybody to plunge into politics in the old-fashioned sense, parties and Congress and all that stuff.
This is Bruce Robbins from Columbia University.
The single most famous thing that he said is that in political theory, we still haven't cut off the king's head. We still think of power, in other words, as a pyramid. And if you can have an impact at the top of the pyramid, you know, it's going to make a difference.
But today that might not be so true. For a lot of people now, the king's head is off, meaning elected officials are seen as only as powerful as the system that props them up, a system we're all a part of.
Foucault gave a lot of people concerned with a lot of different issues the sense that they could and should do something exactly where they are. And this is, you know, the funny thing about his concept of power, that it's kind of everywhere.
It is everywhere. It's not somewhere way up there. And people have taken this to mean a lot of different things. You can fight power, for example, on your Facebook feed.
So I may be going on a little bit of a rant, which is something I don't normally do.
or at your Thanksgiving dinner table.
As much as I'd like to discuss how African Americans and people of color have been marginalized throughout history, resulting in the normalization of their oppression and mistreatment through laws and social norms meant to uphold white supremacy, these sweet potatoes aren't gonna eat themselves.
Or on the football field.
We're talking about Colin Kaepernick. He's the San Francisco 49ers quarterback, and he's been refusing to stand for the national anthem.
Bruce Robbins says you can trace all this to Foucault's idea that
power works through generating norms. And that, I think, has really gotten into a common sense.
It's a contribution that has served social justice movements and tangibly improved people's lives.
People have gotten very, very sensitive to the words they use and the categories they put people into and ways of trying to keep people out of categories. That really has raised the level of civilization in the country.
But Robbins' problem with Foucault is he doesn't have a useful vision for how all of this fits together.
There's no kind of guarantee that what you do over here will be connected somehow to what they're doing over there, and, you know, that it really is all one system.
Some organizers and activists outright reject Foucault.
I think people see differentials in power between themselves and their friends, their coworkers, their clients. Those are all real, but at the same time, there's a much more significant force that socialists recognize as being powerful in our society, and it's the power of the ruling class, it's the power of the capitalist class.
This is Jeremy Gong, an organizer with the National Leadership of the Democratic Socialists of America.
There are three men in this country, Warren Buffett, Jeff Bezos, and Bill Gates, who control half the wealth of the country.
For Gong, you can only challenge that kind of power with a mass movement of the working class.
If they can get together, overcome their differences across race and gender lines and other divisions, they can create a movement that's powerful enough to transform our society. And that means joining organizations, taking part in politics, organizing your workplace. And that is the only way that working people have ever won things that they need.
This isn't a new critique. Foucault was writing in France at a time when Marxism defined intellectual thought. Even though Foucault saw himself as adding to, not against Marxism, many in the workers' movement saw his ideas as undermining or distracting from the cause, kind of like Jeremy Gong does today.
I thought we were an autonomous collective.
You're fooling yourself. We're living in a dictatorship.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Liza Veal.
Thanks, Liza, for that powerful piece on Foucault on power. I'm Ken Taylor. With me is my Stanford colleague, Josh Landy. And today we're talking about Foucault and power.
We're joined now by Gary Gutting, professor of philosophy at the University of Notre Dame, an author of Foucault, A Very Short Introduction, and editor of the Cambridge Companion to Foucault. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Gary.
Glad to be here.
So, Gary, what first got you interested in Foucault and Foucault and power in particular? I mean, I know we academic philosophers have almost no power. So was it like power envy or something?
Right. Well, I like puzzles a lot. And Foucault's books are very puzzling. They're written in a difficult academic language. And I came to enjoy very much decoding that language. And once it was decoded, Foucault turns out to challenge much of our conventional wisdom. And another thing was, I was also intrigued by his puzzling claim that he took on a new identity with each of his books, that he never wanted to be pinned down as this particular author.
So you claim to have decoded Foucault. This is excellent for our purposes. What do you think he actually means by power?
Well, when you talk about power with Foucault, you cannot talk about it apart from knowledge. That's the key point. Let me illustrate that with an example. Suppose you go to a hospital because they have the power to cure you, right? So they've got that power. But the power to cure you lies in doctors. And the doctors themselves, well, they're not just medical experts, they're also part of the hospital as an organization. And that social organization, or even business organization, has goals that go considerably beyond merely taking care of you. It has to think about meeting its payroll, satisfying government regulations, covering up failures that could hurt its reputation. So, as you can't really be sure that the tests, for example, that your doctor is ordering are really medically necessary. They may actually be to get more money from insurance companies or to protect against malpractice suits. So the hospital's power to heal depends on knowledge that's embedded in an institution that has its own agenda.
Well, okay, I get that. That seems right. That's hard to deny. But I didn't hear an analysis or a metaphysical account or anything in what you just said of what power is, especially this normative power that according to our roving report. I mean, does he have a metaphysics of power?
He's not really interested in a theoretical analysis. He will talk about power in a particular context, in a particular time in history, nowadays, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, and he'll key his discussion to that particular situation.
So that's like that we have an analysis of power relations without a metaphysics of power. But you know what, Gary, we're going to come back to these kinds of questions because I'm still a little bit puzzled. But I'll remind our listeners, you're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about Foucault and power with Gary Gutting, author of A Very Short Introduction to Foucault.
How does power relate to knowledge? Is all power at the top or is it distributed throughout society? And how can we resist the control of power?
Power, knowledge, and resistance when Philosophy Talk continues. I've got the power, you've got the power, and she's got the power. Is power really everywhere you look? I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy, and today we're thinking about Foucault and power. Our guest is Gary Gutting from the University of Notre Dame, author of A Very Short Introduction to Foucault.
So, Gary, I kind of get what you were saying in our last segment, but I wanted you to expand on it. And I'm going to give you an enigmatic quote that I have a hard time making sense of, because I'm not sure if it's supposed to be a definition of the nature of power and its relationship to knowledge or some contingent fact or whatever. So here's one example. It is not possible, he says, not possible for power to be exercised without knowledge. It is impossible for knowledge not to engender power. I'm not quite sure what all that means and how it relates to what you were saying about the hospital, for example. Can you help me think about that?
Good luck, Gary.
Yeah. Well, let me talk about that in terms of an example that's very important for Foucault, and that's the prison. Prisons are introduced in the 18th, 19th century as a more humane way of treating offenders. The idea is to move beyond the violence of earlier days, the branding, torture, constant executions. But Foucault has his doubts, saying that the point of modern imprisonment, he thinks, is not so much to punish less, but certainly to punish better. The old violence hurt the body, but prison controls every last detail of convicts' lives and imposes a whole new identity on them. In other words, not only does it control with its power, it transforms the meaning of what they are. It gives new knowledge about what they are. In fact, Foucault would go so far as to say that the modern prison creates criminals. You go in, you're convicted, and once you've been to prison, you are from then on known as a dangerous individual, and there's no way you can ever again have a normal role in society.
Okay, I kind of get that point, Gary. That's related to the thing I was saying to Josh. I think it's kind of related in the opening that, you know, even though there were men who behaved in a certain way, slept with other men in ancient Greece, there weren't gay people as we understand
right.
gay
similarly,
people.
There weren't criminals back then.
Right,
either,
exactly. No. So there wasn't this whole social network. There, this whole nexus of power relations and locations within that whole network of thing. I kind of get that.
Yeah, okay.
Right, but I don't get what that has to do with knowledge exactly. What does that, how does knowledge?
Well, because think about it. Surrounding all of this criminality that we've got are a whole bunch of so-called, at least, sciences like criminology, various sorts of social psychology. And they take the criminal mind as an object. They talk about it. They also, you get a lot of this in education, where we're looking for the early signs through our understanding, our knowledge, of when a student who has only just missed a few classes or taken hooky or something doesn't we suspect that he's got a criminal inclination.
I gotcha.
And so he gets tracked and watched and followed.
So can I see if this is a fair summary. I mean it to be a provocative summary, but I think it's fair. The sciences of criminology and all that stuff, bound up in a whole system of power relations, actually creates the thing it purports to study, right? It doesn't find that. It creates that.
Yeah, that's right. And he actually goes even further than that, because he thinks that the prison, in particular, the techniques of control, like constant surveillance, record-keeping, have become a model in many other modern institutions like schools, hospitals, business offices, factory floors. You start to think about any of those places in Foucauldian terms, and you suddenly realize, wait, they're set up to keep track of people, to keep them under surveillance, to keep records about them, and to categorize them into different kinds of people. The good student, the poor student, the normal student.
This is a very French way of thinking about things, right? You know, you think people are being nice to you. Bah, they are just trying to control you, you know.
Come on.
So, I mean, is it really twisty? Foucault has that line, we're living in a carceral society, right? It's not just the prisons, it's the schools. It's anytime anyone looks like they're being nice to you.
You sound skeptical, Josh.
Right? I mean, is it really true that every time, in every interaction between, for example, a teacher and a pupil, it's all just in the service of this record-keeping, you know, control-exerting power system? That just seems like it's going too far.
I think Foucault is aware of that, in fact, and he's got a great line that I always keep in mind in working with him. He says, it's not that everything is bad, it's that everything is dangerous.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily, power can be very constructive, because it can, in terms of its own interests, realize that it has to make things better. I mean, the doctor gets a lot of credit for actually curing you, right? The hospital, that's a feather in its cap. So it can be a drive towards improvement in things in the world, but at the same time, there's always that danger that it can go the other way. It can be productive, it can be destructive.
So I was reading some Foucault the last couple of weeks trying to get ready for this show. And one of the things that struck me is that Foucault, I don't know if this is quite the way he puts it. Foucault thinks that, let's go back to our Marxist in the Roving Report. I think Foucault thinks that guy is confused because he thinks power equals domination. I mean, power can become domination, but Foucault was talking about power requires freedom and all that, and kind of wide-ranging freedom. Tell me about that, because that's connected to Josh's stuff about the distributed power.
Yeah, I think what's going on there is, he's got a phrase, the microphysics of power. You guys had mentioned before that he doesn't want to think about power in just a hierarchical top-down way, where there's one center from which the power comes down. He thinks that in any society, there are a lot of different locations, schools, factories, families, clubs, universities, where there all of these things are centers of power.
Right.
And they operate individually, but they interact with one another. So you've got a constant back and forth between all sorts of many power sources,
but what about
that make for a very complicated picture.
What about the individual, though? And is there power not in the school, but in the teacher or in the pupil? There's power in the pupil. There's power in the student, the teacher. There's power in the janitor. What about the individual?
What about Foucault himself? Didn't he?
Does he go that far or not?
Well, I think there's power in any individual, that there are always relationships where, well, I mean, think about the student in the school. On the one hand, the student is supposed to be just learning and getting everything from the teacher, who's in total control. But we all know that the students can be very disruptive. In our world, they can give bad teacher evaluations. They can make accusations of sexual harassment. They have lots of resources for exercising counter power against the teacher.
So that's a question. So Foucault, I think, was accused of not having like room for resistance by some people. But it sounds to me like the possibility of resistance is built into only a thing he can't resist, right? But a human being that's in nexus of a power relation, if they have any degree of freedom, and he seems mm-hmm. to think that freedom requires power, there's always a possibility of resistance. Is that how he saw it or not?
Yeah, he does think that. He thinks that his ultimate goal, actually, would be human freedom, human liberation. That's what he wants to help people achieve.
So you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about Foucault and power with Gary Gutting. We'd love to have you join this conversation. And William from Belvedere, what's your brief comment or question, William?
Yes, thank you very much. I'm glad that you finally said something about the individual, because I'm glad that there is no prerequisite to take part in the discussion for ever having read a single word written by Foucault. I think you would have very few callers. However, I think that the average individual is looking at what can they do tomorrow to try to enact the things that they wish would exist in society. And I have a suggestion. May I offer it?
Yeah, if you can do it briefly.
Okay. I think that our society functions on economic power. And therefore, for instance, when I hear that the Koch brothers donated $400 million in the recent election to conservative candidates, I know that I should not buy brawny paper towels, for instance, because they own the company that produces them, and therefore every dollar I spend on, in this case, brawny paper towels, a part of it is going to support causes to which I strongly object. People want to know what they can do tomorrow.
Okay, William, I'm going to put that to Gary. Gary, what would Foucault say people can do tomorrow to, as it were, fight the power or whatever?
Right. He doesn't propose any general program for it. A lot of philosophers who do ethics and political stuff do that. They say, now, here's the way to reform the world. He thinks every problem is different, every situation is different, and you might need different tools at different times to engage in the proper way with it. And he produces a lot of those tools, but he's not giving you some general approach that says, here's how to do it. It's not like a Marxist analysis that would say, here is how you change the world. It's rather, you might use this idea. You mentioned about that notion of an episteme. He's got other ideas about nature of knowledge and nature of power and so on that can be applied in different contexts, but he just is giving you the general scaffolding. He builds a scaffolding that can be moved around, used in different ways, different parts of it.
That seems right, but I still wonder about this question, to what degree Foucault is actually building into his philosophy the idea that we as individuals really have the power to change things. If so much is driven by systems that are independent of individuals and even of groups of individuals. I mean, think about that line of his that, you know, that any given moment, there's always only one episteme that defines the conditions of possibility of all knowledge. I mean, if you take that seriously,
a mistake. He gives it. Okay. That's the impression he gives, especially in The Order of Things. That's really not true. He doesn't really think that.
Is that he doesn't really think that, or that he changes his mind as he goes on? Because, of course, he's famous for having taken a lot of things back in the late work, coming to these
right.
new realizations.
Well, yeah, his way of taking it back is usually to say, no, I never meant that. How could you be so foolish? But, yeah.
That's the Donald Trump way.
In the immediately following book after that, where he comments in detail on and develops further that notion of an episteme, it's perfectly clear that there are epistemes, Kuhnian paradigm type things are all over different locations in a given society. It's not global. He doesn't think that.
Well, he doesn't think that, but it seems to me. So I've been teaching Simone de Beauvoir this quarter as part of another of a course I'm doing. And yeah. I love this thing. This is in the Ethics of Ambiguity. She says it's a speaking world from which solicitations rise up from every corner. It's and the solicitations are rising up from individual subjects, and nothing can stand over against the, well, there are all kinds of things that stand over against the individual subject, but the individual subject should resist and like this deal with this ambiguity of pure internality and blah, blah, blah. Foucault seems really, really, really to downplay this internality thing, to subjectivity, consciousness.
He doesn't like that existentialist emphasis on the self and self-scrutiny. He's against that.
Yeah.
It's also true, the individuals can do things, but I think he thinks the real locus of resistance to power has got to be the actual marginal groups who are being exploited, mistreated, and that if people want to help, they'd best, he had an organization that worked with prisoners and tried to give prisoners themselves the voice to express their views and get out on the table what they needed, because he didn't think you could speak for others. You could only maybe make a path so they could get heard by the authorities.
But wait a minute. Doesn't that push us back onto the work to be done by the subjectivity of the marginalized? So aren't we bringing back subjectivity here in a deep way? Isn't that contrary to the centrality, his claims about the non-centrality of subjectivity? Just give me a brief answer to that, then we had to go to a break.
Subjectivity is a very big thing for him. He doesn't want to understand it the way the existentialists do, where it's a matter of introspective analysis. But subjectivity is a very positive category for him, and he ties it up closely with truth and the telling of truth to others.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about Foucault and power with Gary Cutting, author of A Very Short Introduction to Foucault.
How can today's activists make use of Foucault's ideas about power? What can we do when injustice is systemic?
How to fight the power when Philosophy Talk continues.
If you enjoy our program, there are lots of ways you can support what we do.
Subscribe to our enormous archive of past episodes.
Buy subscriptions for the thinkers in your life.
Purchase someone a mug, tote, or tea at our new online shop.
Or make a tax-deductible donation by going to philosophytalk.org.
Please do your part to help keep us on the air and online.
Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking. Can you really fight the power, or is resistance futile, as the Borg would say? I'm Ken Taylor, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy, and our guest is Gary Gutting from the University of Notre Dame. Today, we're thinking about Foucault and power.
So, Gary, I want to take you back a step to what you said about subjectivity. I think I got it, I think, but I'm going to try out a thought on you. The difference between, say, existentialist celebration of subjectivity and Foucault's take on subjectivity. Here's one thing I guess you might think. You might think, like a Cartesian, that the subject in his or her pure subjectivity is prior to all this stuff, right? And then encounters all this stuff. I guess there's a kind of thing sort of like that in the existentialist, but the existentialist encounters this externality and has to deal with it. Foucault seems to think the subject itself is somehow, as the subject, is somehow constructed somehow by this system of power relations. Is that a plausible thought? And
yeah, that's a good way to think about it. A good example that we haven't mentioned before, but I think it's worth it in this context, is his views about sex. He was deeply suspicious, in particular, of the 1960s sexual revolution. The revolution presents itself as a liberation from repressive Victorian prudery, as you would call it. But Foucault maintained that we are just new sorts of Victorians.
Right.
We endlessly scrutinize our sex lives, going over them minutely, thinking about them, talking about them, getting advice about them, to be sure that we're living up to the new standards of tolerant, boundary-expanding sexuality. I mean, think about magazines like Playboy and Cosmo, with their constant insistence on you should have to have new experiences, you have to develop new techniques, you have to become a better lover, you have to get rid of your old hang-ups. And he says that shows that we are so devoted to not being prudes in the Victorian sense that we become prudish in another way about demands to be open, to be more tolerant, and to push ourselves to boundaries that might be quite uncomfortable for us.
Gary, you can't see how Josh is shaking his head in disgust, not at you, at Foucault, yeah, as channeled through you.
Yeah, yeah.
He thinks
that sexual ethics is just as confining as the old family values one. His great line is, he says, after he gets finished with the whole discussion, the irony is that anyone thought the sexual revolution had anything to do with liberation.
Yeah, I mean, he thought that for a moment, and then he changed his mind. I mean, this was the kind of French Foucault's kind of hip cynicism that, as you say in your book, you know, he comes to California and he writes a very different kind of book, and of course gives some other interviews where all of a sudden he's saying, you know what, some of these practices of self-fashioning aren't bogus. They aren't just matters of, you know, buying into a new set of restrictive social norms. They're actually genuinely liberating. But so even Foucault didn't believe this throughout his career.
But he goes back, when he gets to that stage, you're right, he goes back to models from ancient Greece and Rome, interestingly.
Sure, but so what? I mean, the fact that they existed once is evidence that they can exist. And so why should it be the case that you know, the sexual liberation was not liberating? Maybe he just made a mistake.
So, Gary, why don't you answer that? Then I'm going to take a call. You got something to respond to that or not?
Well, I think he would have said that if we look at the modern situation in the 20th and 21st centuries, his analysis would hold true. But it's true, he thinks that there are ways of having legitimate subjectivity, right? Where you can fashion your own life. Well, of course, he was trying to do that with this project of saying, I write my books to become a different person every time.
Right, right.
So that was built in from the beginning.
We've got a caller, Al, from somewhere in the Bay Area is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Al, in the Bay Area.
Hello, Ken. Hello, everybody there. I'm just curious what anyone would say, Foucault would say, or any of you would say, about how words bind us to the power when we're in society. If you're not in society, I don't know how words work there. But in society, you're a master at something. So you've got the power of the police state to correct whatever is deviant from what you feel is right. Is there power in there that Foucault or any of you would like to jump in on?
Well, I could say a lot to say about that, but I'm going to focus your question on language, because you started out talking about words, and Foucault has a lot to say about how language shapes this stuff. So can you give us a really brief account, Gary, of Foucault on language?
Yeah, no, that's very big for him, especially his earlier work. It was he even talked about doing what he called an archaeology, which was really an archaeology of language, and different societies, different cultures have a whole different set of words they use, and things that seem perfectly obvious 200 years ago seem totally ridiculous to us now. And so there's a foreignness to the past that actually makes it very useful for us, because it can help us broaden our horizons. But language was really important. All along, he also thinks that whatever it is that's beyond language, he does have that fascination with the irrational, and the artist on the borderline of insanity. He likes to talk about Nietzsche a lot and Van Gogh and people like that. He thinks that there's this, early on especially, I think that drops out a little bit more later on, but he thinks there is even a non-linguistic another dimension. But language is utterly important, especially in the social level.
Yeah, this is something we could go on and on about. It is a big topic in Foucault, and one I find at times fascinating and at times frustrating. I disagree with a lot, and I agree with some, but that's a really big topic. But I want to ask you some kind of forward-looking thing. I'm thinking about today's activist movements. Going back to the piece, I mean, you could have different views about the relevance of Foucault today's activist movements. What do you think? How should today's activist movements, from Black Lives Matter to Me Too to all these different things, think about?
Well, one thing about Foucault that's attracted almost everybody is he has a really fertile theoretical mind, all sorts of ideas. They keep coming, coming and coming. And he offers intriguing ideas about nature of knowledge, structure of power, role of truth in politics, many, many things. But what many readers do is think that what he's given them is a universal account, a general theory that'll apply everywhere. That is what's least in his mind. He does not mean that. As I said before, I like the analogy of scaffolding. He will build a theory. He'll build a theory about sexuality or about prisons, and he will develop it for the sake of understanding this particular phenomenon in this particular book. But he doesn't ever commit himself to a general picture or method. So I think we should follow his lead. Here I would bring up a metaphor that he uses constantly. He says that the results of his work are really just a toolbox, that it's not a machine for producing definite results, but a whole set of different tools that can be used to end intolerable ways of treating marginal groups like prisoners, immigrants, ethnic minorities. And so his primary audience is people who are working in what you might call the social trenches, the people who are leaders of movements like Black Lives Matter.
I like this idea of the toolbox, and it made me think. I've been thinking a lot recently about Black Lives Matter and other of today's crucial activist movements, and thinking that, you know, Black Lives Matter really, as Ken was saying earlier, they really seem to have put into practice this Foucauldian idea of distributed power. And I contrast that. I'm not sure if you would agree with this in contrasting it with talk these days about cultural appropriation, that I think is equally important as a topic. But I worry sometimes that talk about cultural appropriation has a more kind of vertical picture of a sort of hegemonic us and an oppressed them, as opposed to a more, you know, a picture of circulation of power that would be more Foucauldian. What do you think about that?
I don't know if he would... I don't think the mere notion of appropriation, cultures do interact, they learn from one another. I think he's all for that. But it is true that there are many ways of marginalizing the people that you don't care about in your society. That's true.
So, but you said he doesn't have any general method or theory, but I wanted to draw a general lesson at least. And let's tell me if you think I could draw this lesson. So when you're in a moment, in a historical moment, you have to analyze the concrete particularity of your situation. And it's unfolding, it's coming to be, the structure of power relations. And that's, so don't look to Marx and his forever standing class analysis, or Hegel and the dialectic of history. Look to analyze your situation and find out what the concrete power structures are and all that.
Well, there is really interesting, because what he wants to do, when he wants to understand a contemporary problem, is say, look, we have a restricted viewpoint. We're just within our own particular episteme, if you like, our own paradigm. But we can get out of that, at least to a serious extent, by looking at the past and seeing how differently they thought and trying to come to terms with that way of thinking. So he actually uses the analysis of the past as a way of breaking us free of our own prejudices, our own limitations.
Well, Gary, on that note, this has been an empowering conversation, and I'm really glad and thankful to you for joining us.
Thank you. I was glad to be here.
Our guest has been Gary Gutting. He's a professor of philosophy at the University of Notre Dame, my beloved alma mater. He's author of Foucault, A Very Short Introduction, and he's also editor of The Cambridge Companion to Foucault. So, Josh, do you have any empowering, newly empowered Foucauldian thoughts?
Well, it's so hard with Foucault because, you know, some of it is unclear and some of it's kind of extreme on the negative side, and he takes a bunch of it back. But, you know, some of it's very powerful. I think in particular of the part of his thinking that's being picked up by Black Lives Matter, I think that's really important.
You know, I have all kinds of ideas about normativity and stuff, and I used to be accused of being, Taylor, you're really just a Hegelian. And lately I've been accused of, Taylor, you're really Foucault in disguise. So I suppose I have some internal affinity for some of
that's
these.
That's just power speaking through you, Ken.
I've started Foucault a fair number of times, and I've never been able to get through. It's just exhausting kind of way. Yeah. But there is a lot of fascinating things to it. But you know what? This conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is, with apologies to Descartes, cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you can become a partner in that community just by visiting our website and clicking around a bit, philosophytalk.org.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send it to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we may feature it on our blog. Now, since knowledge is power is speed, let's hear from Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes is a wannabe avant-garde guy in college. I read The Theater and Its Double by the poet Artaud, a huge influence on alternative theater. He wrote, quote, "If there is still one hellish, truly accursed thing in our time, it is our artistic dallying with forms instead of being like victims burnt at the stake, signaling through the flames," unquote. Now, being a young man, I thought, that's cool. Not cool enough to ignite myself on stage, of course, but cool enough to cite at parties. Somewhere I read that Foucault had read Artaud, which led me to his book, Madness and Civilization, about how the insane of the Middle Ages were once allowed to wander in the villages but then put on ships for the ships to wander, the so-called Ship of Fools. This book fit right into one taxonomy of the 70s, you know, the who are we to say who's crazy in this crazy world genre, One for Over the Cuckoo's Nest, King of Hearts, Artie Lang, Thomas Sawes. And I went on to read The Birth of the Clinic and The Order of Things, and then Foucault got a bit too dense for me. I would get to the end of a sentence and not know where I'd been. So I moved on to the teachings of Don Juan, A Yaqui Way of Knowledge, as God intended. You can see Foucault's appeal to the post-hippie college-educated boomer. He's like Marxism without the Marxism. He's like Chomsky, only he leaves the house sometimes, in black leather. He's all about power, what it is, how it works. Can you get out of the way? Well, no, he wasn't about advice. Archaeology is what he called what he did. A Foucauldian claim made insouciantly back in the day was that biology itself was an instrument of power. Powers in taxonomy, nomenclature, species, and genuses, the very act of description. Looking at something through a microscope is a way to gain control over the thing viewed, how it's viewed, who gets to view it. The person with the lenses and the binomials is the person with the power. I'd never thought of it that way before. How you structure information is a source of power. Nothing to be done about it. At least Foucault didn't offer any microscopic revolutions with little tiny barricades. But Foucault did not dispute the truthiness, if you will, of these structures. Microscopes and naming did give us the names for diseases and led to cures. And yet there does seem to be a kind of social Darwinist spin on Foucault. Some people opt out of vaccinations because they're perceived as a power play by Big Pharma to, I don't know what, give our kids autism. Low-level paranoia may be an appropriate response to a Foucauldian view of the world. The will to power is also behind the will to knowledge. Real-life app? Deregulation of the airwaves allowed drug makers to advertise an explosion of mysterious nostrums. They have names like Incivic, Adcetris, Yervoy, Veibrid, Zydiga, Exgiva. These are targeted at real ailments and also self-diagnosed diseases that match your self-observed symptoms. As the ads say, ask your doctor if Rosipnid is right for you. In some ways, it's a brave new world of small medical miracles. In others, it's a Foucauldian dystopian nightmare. Or take Uber. It's a bold new direction in capitalism. You're your own boss. You make your own hours. But you're a slave to the algorithms. Meet the new boss, meaner than the old boss, because he's a robot. You carry your own panopticon with you on your smartphone. I just read that Foucault's being read in business management classes, the importance of taxonomy. Just a small example. How do you convince people to store all their information on other people's computers? That sounds kind of crazy. Well, you call it the cloud. driving people into bankruptcy and despair? Let's call that disruption. It's why we have Facebook today, and we are as victims, burning at the stake, signaling through the flames. Or maybe we're just trying to hail a cab. Silly martyr, put your hand down. Use the Uber app on your smartphone. You got the power, darling. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW Local Public Radio San Francisco and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2018.
Our executive producers are David Demarest and Tina Pamantorn.
The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Angela Johnston, and Lauren Schechter.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Take this object, but beware, it carries a terrible curse.
Ooh, that's bad.
But it comes with a free Frogurt.
That's good.
The Frogurt is also cursed.
That's bad.
But you get your choice of topping.
That's good.
The toppings contain potassium benzoate. That's bad.
Can I go now?